Now, Edward R. Murrow and the voices of President Harry S. Truman, General Douglas MacArthur, General George C. Marshall, Senator Joseph McCarthy, the New York Narcotics Hearings, the graduates of Afton High School, and more than 40 other men and women in the news in the 27th performance of Hear It Now.
Oh, I lived 1,000 lives in that one split second. I had a feeling that I was standing at the gates of hell, looking into eternity.
Who plunged us into the Korean War and assumed other global commitments without reckoning and being ready to meet their potential consequences?
Remember, this place is going to be filled with people. No gum chewing. I will come around with a piece of paper, and you will give me any gum that you have.
Hear It Now. The Columbia Broadcasting System and 173 affiliated radio stations present a document for air, based on the week's news and the men and women who made it. All the voices and sounds you will hear are real and are presented as they were recorded in the heat and confusion of a world in crisis. Here is the editor of Hear It Now, the distinguished reporter and news analyst, Edward R. Murrow.
It was a week to study narcotics in high school washrooms, lost diplomats, the biggest explosion in history, high prices, lost oil, and the class of 1951. It was also the week for the two most written about and supported Americans to complain about the damage of hostile propaganda. Douglas MacArthur and Harry Truman both spoke on Wednesday. The voices were different, the complaints almost identical. First, General MacArthur in Austin, Texas.
From those who so bitterly assail me, there has been no word of response. Only cynical silence, only the hypocrisy of pretense, only the constant flow of slanted propaganda.
That same morning, the president spoke of death on the highways of the United States and asked why the hostile press and propagandists didn't blame him for these, as they blamed him for the casualties in Korea.
There's no outcry by the sabotage press, no misstatement by the economists, or the congressional demagogues, and I wonder why. I wonder why. Now, that's an opportunity for every one of those fellows to pick on the administration, and they ought to make use of it.
Both sides claimed foul by propaganda. Both protagonists in the great debate claimed that truth had been abused, called out for unity and boldness. Ambassador Warren Austin, a Republican who serves a Democratic executive, was not afraid.
In time of crisis, we find our unity, not the unity of the garrison state, but what General Eisenhower calls the unity of free men who will not be divided.
In Washington, the cause of truth and free men who will not be divided was being served on the floor of the Senate by Joseph McCarthy of Wisconsin. On Tuesday, the senator sent every one of his colleagues a note announcing that on Thursday he would attack General Marshall. It wasn't until late Thursday afternoon that Senator McCarthy's colleagues gave him the floor and heard his exposé.
I deal with Marshall's actions, not his motives. I decided that the record of Marshall's unbroken series of decisions and actions which contributed so greatly to the strategy of defeat, should be given not from the pens and lips of his critics, but from sources friendly to him. Perhaps the most interesting part of the Marshall record over the past decade deals with the important part he played in the history-making struggles between Winston Churchill and Joe Stalin. Fortunately, on at least one important occasion, Roosevelt sided with Churchill and against Stalin and Marshall. This dealt with the North African landing. At that time, Stalin was very much opposed to our entering the Mediterranean. Churchill, of course, wanted us to enter that. Marshall sided with Stalin. I think we can thank Roosevelt for that one time when he overrode Stalin, because if he had not done so, then just as certain as we are here today, Russia would control the entire Mediterranean. Another great struggle between Churchill and Stalin was over whether or not we should invade what Churchill called the soft underbelly of the Axis. Churchill, of course, wanted Allied troops stationed in Eastern Europe when the war ended. Stalin obviously wanted Russian troops stationed in Eastern Europe when the war ended. That time, Marshall fought vigorously on the side of Stalin, threatened to resign his position and get Eisenhower to resign if Roosevelt did not side with Stalin. Unfortunately, Roosevelt did that. Another interesting part of the Marshall record were the activities of Marshall at Yalta. The memoirs of Marshall's good friends show that Roosevelt, who was in failing health, was given only the type of intelligence report which they thought he should get in order to induce him to go along with Joe Stalin, which he did. Perhaps the next important phase of Marshall's record is the almost criminal folly of the disastrous Marshall mission to China. At that time, there was signed the death warrant of the vast number of Americans who have died in the hills and valleys of Korea since then.
These are merely a few of the highlights from Senator McCarthy's 60,000-word story of George Catlett Marshall, compiled, as he tells us, from the pens and lips of sources friendly to him. There is much more that these sources have written and spoken that is not in the record compiled by the senator from Wisconsin. To keep the record straight, Winston Churchill wrote, "Marshall was a rugged soldier, a magnificent organizer and builder of armies, a statesman with a penetrating and commanding view of the whole situation." Admiral Leahy wrote, "Marshall as a soldier was one of the best, and his drive, courage, and imagination transformed America's great citizen army into the most magnificent force ever assembled." Bernard Baruch has said, "It was General Marshall who organized the means which made possible victory on all fronts in World War II. Always, he has seemed to me the very prototype of the soldier statesman." The late General Hap Arnold wrote, "It is hard to think there could have been an Air Force in World War II without Marshall." Princeton University has said of him, "General Marshall possesses in full measure the faith and confidence of the American people, a faith and confidence based upon long observation of his simplicity, integrity, forceful ability, courage, and selfless love of country." It is this same man whom Senator McCarthy accuses of being a leader in what he calls a conspiracy so immense, an infamy so black, as to dwarf any in the previous history of man. And it is the same George Catlett Marshall, of whom the great Republican statesman, the late Henry L. Stimson, said at the end of the last war, "I have had considerable experience with men in government. General Marshall has given me a new gauge of what such service should be. The destiny of America at the most critical time of its national existence has been in the hands of a great and good citizen. Let no man forget it." Great and good citizen, or arch conspirator, Secretary of Defense George Marshall is still in harness as a servant of his government. This week, he completed a 5-day mission to Korea. Arriving in Japan, reporters asked him why he made the trip.
"Why I'm here? I went over to see the 8th Army."
Back in Washington on Tuesday, General Marshall reported on how he found the 8th Army.
"I found the 8th Army in most effective shape. It's a very highly professional force, probably the most ably trained and operated army that we've ever had."
Another general, the center of another controversy, made another mission this week.
"You will please rise and face General MacArthur and let us sing together the song of the Texans.
For more than a month, since he told his story to two Senate committees, General Douglas MacArthur has listened and read, but made no major pronouncements. Tonight he is winding up a three-speech tour of Texas. Time and the testimony given the Senate investigators have not dulled the general's desire to tell Americans what's wrong with America. He is appalled by a national policy he feels is geared to timidity and fear, by the fact that we are not prepared to fight. He wants us to find out why.
Who, we should ask, is responsible for the reduction of our military strength from the greatest on earth at war's end to that they now estimate is inadequate even to support our moral commitment? Who plunged us into the Korean War and assumed other global commitments in the face of such alleged weakness without reckoning and being ready to meet their potential consequences?
That is the general speaking at Austin, where he offered this military advice.
Our first line of defense for Western Europe is not the Elbe, it is not the Rhine, it is the Yalu. Lose there, and you render useless the effort to implement the North Atlantic Pact or any other plan for regional defense. What gullibility to think the free world would fight for freedom in Europe after refusing to do so in Asia.
Last night in Houston and today in San Antonio, the general laid aside Korea and China, the troops and global policies, and spoke of what he's found in America since his return. Insidious forces working from within this country. An invisible government based on false propaganda. An internal threat more to be feared than any enemy from the outside. In Houston, the general undertook to define those he charges with spreading fear in our midst.
There are those who subvert morality as the means to gain or entrench power. There are those who, believing themselves liberals, chart a course which can but lead to destruction. There are those cynically inclined whose restless impulse is ever seeking change. There are those who seek to prevent men from fearlessly speaking their minds according to the dictates of their conscience.
Minutes after the general completed his speech, the President of the United States, speaking from the quiet of his White House office, addressed the nation on another problem. The President, too, sees an internal threat to the country that might accomplish more than enemy armies. The threat of inflation.
This is a time of national danger. The welfare of all of us is at stake. If inflation gets away from us and wrecks our savings and ruins our economy, it would be the easiest victory the Kremlin could ask for. Communist Russia would win the whole world to totalitarianism without firing a shot. It is up to the Congress to pass a strong anti-inflation law so this country can do its full part in the fight for world peace.
This is a battle Mr. Truman has fought before. He remembers the nature and the record of his opposition.
Some people are telling the Congress now that we can get along without price or wage or rent control. That's the way the National Association of Manufacturers is talking these days. They're just as wrong now as they were back in 1946. They told us then if we would just put an end to price controls, everything would be rosy and prices would stay right in line. Do you remember that? The National Association of Manufacturers had its way in 1946. The Congress failed to pass a good price control law. And then we had the biggest wave of price increases in modern history. Do you think the National Association of Manufacturers has learned anything from that? They haven't learned a thing. Not a thing. Here they are again giving us the same old song and dance. Take off price controls and everything will be just dandy.